Dan Ariely is a leading behavioral economist, a three-time best-selling author, and most impressively, he's the first guest to appear multiple times on Maker Stories. This episode, we talk about Dan's new documentary on dishonesty and cheating, and why people cheat in sports, politics, relationships, and virtually every field. I also ask him who are his favorite thinkers, what are the limits of behavioral economics, how he met his wife, and how he views the term success. All right, here's Dan.
Okay, so first off, this is your third time on the podcast. The first person has been on three times, but I know that we could just, I have an endless list of questions I can ask you. And the first time we talked about products, the second time we talked about relationships, and this time I want to touch on a few different topics, but I want to talk about some projects you're working on related to dishonesty. So tell me both about the documentary that's just launching and the upcoming book.
Okay, so first of all, thanks for having me here for three times. I view this as a privilege, so I appreciate it. I actually became interested in dishonesty with personal observation. So I don't know if this happens to you, but I was on an air on a flight, and I looked at one of those magazines, and there was a Mensa test. You know, and the Mensa is the society of people who think very highly of themselves, and they have very high IQ. And I was curious to see whether I could fit with that group. So there was, you know, a test on, let's say, page 20, and it says, for the answers, look at page 150. So I look at the first question, I look at the second, I form my opinion, I go to the back of the book, the magazine, I see I was basically, I was correct for the first two, but then I glance at the answers for the third and fourth question. And it was B and A. And then I go back, and the next two questions were much easier. And then I keep on, you know, checking myself and going back and forth. And eventually I basically proved to myself what a genius I was. And the thing that made me curious was how quickly I was to convince myself that I was a genius, rather than realizing that I probably kind of cheated on the exam. I knew the answer, and once I knew the answer, it was easier to find out the reasons why, yes, I knew this all along. And then when I got back to the lab, I started talking with my students, and we came up with a method to measure dishonesty. And since then, by the way, we've come up with all kinds of measures to all kinds of ways to measure dishonesty. I'll give you one of those. So imagine I gave you a die. It's a regular six-sided die, and I'll tell you that I'll pay you based on what it comes on. One, you get $1, three, three, five, five, six, six, and so on. And I said, look, you can get paid based on the top side or the bottom side. Top or bottom, you decide, but don't tell me. So in your mind, you think top, bottom, top, bottom, top, bottom. You decide which one you want, and then you roll the die. And let's say it came with two on the top and five on the bottom. And then I say, what did you decide, top or bottom? Now, if you decide bottom, you say bottom and you get $5. If you decide top and it came up with two on the top, now you have a dilemma. Do you say the truth? Do you say I thought about two? Or do you say I thought about bottom? You basically change your opinion after the fact. And we get people to do this 20 times. Every time they think top or bottom, they roll. And what we basically find is that people are extra lucky. We find that, you know, you would expect people to be correct half of the time to get the higher sign, but people get about 14 or 15 times. Now, very few people are lucky all the time, but most people are lucky too often. Now, that's the basic paradigm. And what happens on top of that is that we find that people are sensitive to all kinds of new things that make us, I don't want to say them, make us cheat more. So let me ask you as an example. Imagine you play this game and you were sitting next to your significant other. And your significant other doesn't know what's going on in your brain, but your significant other can see whether you are exaggerating or not. They can see whether you're extra lucky or not. So what do you think? When you sit next to your significant other, would you cheat more, the same, or less?
More.
That's right. You cheat more. And why?
We want to impress them.
Okay, so that's an interesting hypothesis. By the way, we chose luck games because luck games don't reflect skills. So you're absolutely right that if we chose a skill game, it could be that you're showing skills off. But in this case, it's just luck There's no real skill in that. But we did another experiment in which people did the same thing, and we connected them to a lie detector. And what we found out is that the lie detector can detect very well when people are lying. Not all the time, but detect very well. In another version of the experiment, people were lying for charity. What happens now? Now the lie detector cannot detect anything. People lie a little bit more, and the lie detector cannot detect anything. Why? Because when you cheat for other people, you don't feel as bad about it. Think about Robin Hood. If we connected Robin Hood to a lie detector, do you think he would have felt bad? Of course not. Right? So when you sit there and your significant other sits next to you, you all of a sudden realize you're cheating for them as well. It's not just for you, it's for both of you, and all of a sudden you feel better about it. So we've done all of these research on cheating and what causes people to cheat more and cheat less, and then Enron came. This was a while ago, and all of a sudden this research that was about my curiosity about my own cheating on Mensa test became something more important in society. Because when Enron came out as a scandal, the initial reaction was, here are three bad people. But you see, in our experiments, we found that the vast majority of people were cheating just a little bit. It wasn't about bad people. In fact, we couldn't find any really bad people, the people who cheat all the way, but we found lots of little cheaters. So I became more interested, and then we started doing more and more and more experiments to understand the complexity and the nuances of cheating. And then every time I wrote about it or talk about it and so on, the question came, how connected are these little cheating? You know, you can come and you can, you know, cheat us off $40 or $50 in half an hour. How much is this the same as big cheating? How much is this the same phenomena? Now, we don't have millions of dollars to lose to cheaters, and also when people come to the lab, it's not the same as real life. So I teamed up with Yael Melamed, who is a great film producer. And together we said, look, let's just talk to big cheaters. Let's talk to people who've committed all kinds of crimes across a whole range. And let's not talk to them about what they did at the end. I mean, we'll get to it at some point. But let's try to understand their first step. What was the first thing they did? And we talked to about 40 of those. We've done interviews. Each interview is about 3 hours. And you know what? Aside from one guy, these were all stories of slippery slopes. These were all stories when you look at the end of it, you said, my goodness, I could have never done any of that. But when you look at the first step they took, you said, you know what? I could have done that. And many of those first steps, by the way, were not for self-benefit. They were for the benefit of others. So there was one accountant for a company that was doing generally well. They were profitable. But that one quarter, Wall Street had extra high expectations from them. And they needed to reach Wall Street expectation because of some expansion program. And he lied. He cooked the books, and he made them look like they were making more money than they did. And it worked for that quarter, but then the next quarter, life became harder. And then harder and harder and harder. And eventually, he found himself cooking the book for 8 years, and he went to prison for quite a while. But, you know, you look at it at the end and you say, would I cook the books for many years? And you would say, of course not. But you would say, well, if the company was really stressed out and the CEO really asked me if it was only for one quarter, could I have been convinced to push things just a little bit in terms of receivable and account payables and just make things look slightly rosier because we were, after all, making money and so on? Under those conditions, people feel very differently, but then, of course, it becomes worse and worse and worse. And by the way, can you guess what was the one guy who was the exception that did not have a slippery slope?
Madoff? I don't know. Was he doing it from the beginning or who?
Yeah, so actually Madoff is interesting because we couldn't talk to Madoff, but we talked to his judge, Jed Rakoff. Mm-hmm. And Madoff's judge didn't think that he planned it from the beginning. Right, he said, you know, if you were going to plan something like this, wouldn't you have an island somewhere and a plane, and your son wouldn't commit suicide? You know, the way it went down is just not. He's just either not very smart and not thinking about really planning it, or it was just not planned from the beginning and just was like all the slippery slope stories. Mm-hmm. But the one guy that didn't fit this slippery slope notion was a guy who grew up in a mafia family. And he grew up basically with these notions of, you know, there are no morals considerations. And you can cheat and you can steal and none of those are moral issues. What was also interesting though about this mafia guy was that while he had no morals for anybody outside of the family, he had incredibly strong morals for people in the family. Right? If you're in the family and you got his handshake, you don't need a contract. It was clear it was going to happen, right? So he was basically brought up to have these very different morals than the rest of us. And his world was kind of divided into within the family, very high morals, outside of the family, is just about profit maximizing, which was very interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting, this concept of kind of separate moral, like two different worlds. Like in one area, I'm going to act very, very just. In another area, I'm going to act, you know, in a totally different way.
Yeah, and you know, it's not very different for most of us. So, you know, when I ask my undergrads how many of them have illegal music on their computers, they all do. And when I ask them how many of them feel bad about it, nobody feel bad about it. Now, they know it's illegal. I ask them, how many of you have illegal music on your computer? So it's not a mystery, it's illegal, but they don't feel bad about it, right? So what happened is for undergrads, they take a domain like music and they say, this is not a moral question. I don't feel bad about it. I don't feel embarrassed about it. Sam, you know, he took everything that had to do with not his family and said he doesn't care about it. So it's much more extreme. And this is also what corruption is about. So if you've been to countries where there's corruption, like in South Africa, people tell you, oh, you know, I was driving too fast. A policeman stopped me. I gave him a little bit of money. He went away. People are not embarrassed about it. The moment you have no embarrassment, it means there's no force inside that is stopping you. You don't feel bad about it. And now it's just about the cost benefit, but it's not a moral consideration anymore.
And so what in making this documentary, what's been the most surprising thing that you've learned or that surprised you? And what is what's the thing which you think there needs to be more research that you haven't uncovered that you wish you did?
So first of all, it was amazing to see how much of the dishonesty was very much like our experiments. How it was about rationalization, it was about helping other people, it was doing it just for now. Incredibly similar. So that was interesting. There were also some really touching cases. So for example, there was a policeman who got a confession from this woman on a murder, and only later he realized that she could have never done that. Like there was zero chance she murdered the guy. And he went back to see his own interview and he realized that he basically got her to have a false confession. And he basically said that the police manual is a manual for extracting false confession from people. And he basically said that what he was doing was not very different from what people in Wall Street were doing. That he had a quota, he had this open case, it was open for 2 years, he couldn't find the murderer. Then he found this woman, she seemed like she was reasonable, and he was in wishful blindness, wanted to find out that she was the murderer. And he basically convinced himself, and then basically got her to admit something that was wrong. But in his world, he was always fighting for justice. He was not thinking of himself as evil, but he was thinking of himself as somebody who's uncovering justice. Now, you know, we've done lots of stuff on all the things that get people to cheat. Oh, can I tell you one more study?
Please.
Okay, so this is one of my favorite studies. So I own a candy machine. And for this experiment, I posted the price outside of the machine to say 75 cents. But inside the vending machine, I said it was free. So no matter how much money you put, the machine gave it all to you back the moment you press on the bar with the candy. So you would put money in, you would press a button, and the machine would give you the candy and the money. And there was a big sign that says, if something is wrong with the machine, please call this number, and it was my cell phone number. And how many people do you think called?
Very little.
Yeah, that's right, zero. Really, as little as you can. And how many candies do you think people took?
Quite a bit. I don't know.
So people took three or four. Nobody took five.
Wow.
Right? And you could see how taking five would be stealing. But three or four, you can rationalize it. You could say, I remember another vending machine that took my money, didn't give me candy. I'm just evening up the karma, my vending karma here. And the other thing that people did was they called their friends to participate as well. And I think the logic was that, you know, if other people do it, it's not as bad as well. So you think about this experiment, it's about how do we rationalize, how much we can rationalize, and how you use others to rationalize more dishonesty. And those are things we find in all the experiments. Now, you asked me, what do I think we need to study? So look, when I say lots of people cheat, in our experiments, the majority cheats. Let's say 70, 80% of the people cheat, depending on the experiment. But it's not 100%. And what we don't know is whether there are people who never cheat or whether in each particular day there are some people who don't cheat. So imagine we did the same experiment or different versions of it over a period of a month, and every day we tempted people to cheat. Would there be some people who never cheated? There's one possibility is that different people would cheat on different days. Another one is that some people would basically not never cheat. Now, I have one speculation about one type of people who never cheat, but we haven't gotten to test this. So often when I give talks, some people come to me and they say, you know, my kid can never cheat, can never lie. And I try to teach them how to be dishonest, and it's impossible. And in all cases when people come to deal with this, those are kids on the autistic spectrum. And if you think about autism, autism is a problem. One of the issues is a problem with theory of mind. How well do I understand you, your state? And lying basically starts with the theory of mind. It says, I understand what would offend you. And even though that you're doing something that is not nice, I will not tell you about it. I will not point out to you. Lying actually starts some from personal preservation, but it comes from understanding that other people want us to do some things and not others, and that if we want to be nice to other people, there are some things we can do. And it could be that kids on the autistic spectrum, probably adults as well, have a harder time being dishonest. So we those are two things we don't know. Are the people who don't cheat consistently, and are those people connected with some kind of autism spectrum?
And is the implication, there's this analogy in baseball that, I don't know if this is 100% correct, but everyone, or biking or cycling, that like everyone's doing some sort of illegal drug, and if you don't do this illegal drug or steroids or whatever, you're at a disadvantage. Does that
yes.
play a role like in life with like little white lies here and there or that sort of thing? Or is it kind of different?
So absolutely. So the idea that everybody else is doing it is a tremendous justification. So when Oprah Winfrey interviewed Lance Armstrong and she said, did you feel you were cheating? He said, no, I was just evening up the odds. He sounded like a psychopath. But the cyclists we've talked to basically all say the same thing. Is that, you know, we as outsiders, we don't realize how it felt on the inside. But on the inside, they felt that everybody was doing it. And one of the cyclists we talked to, he was not a cyclist for 2 years, did not compete. Then he comes back, and he's slower. And everybody's faster. He's actually not slower. He's the same. Everybody else is faster. And he asked one of his friends, said, what's going on? And his friend gives him an address. And he goes to this address and he meets a doctor with a white coat, and the doctor tests him and gives him a prescription for EPO. EPO is a drug they use to create more red blood cells for cancer. And he goes to the pharmacy and he gets the drug, and the pharmacist charges insurance company. He only pays the copay. And then he gives himself the first injection. And when he gives himself the first injection, he kind of thinks about it. But that's it. And then the rest of the injections just become part of his routine. And then he discovers that everybody in the team is doing it, and they're all doing it publicly. Then the team owners start giving people other drugs as well. Then there's a shortage of EPO. But he has some friends on the Chinese team, so they hook him up with a factory in China. And he imports some And then another team finds out and they ask him if they would import for him, for them. So he does. And now he's a drug dealer, right, when they catch him. But you can see how things start, and they start very differently than how they end. And all of these things, like everybody else is doing it, and a doctor gave me the prescription, and the insurance company paid for it, all makes it feel much more okay. Now, if you really thought about it, you would know this is not okay. But if you closed your eyes slightly and kind of became with some wishful blindness, you could convince yourself that you're actually okay.
And so do you think this a knowledge problem, just that people don't know what it's really like, and they don't know what other people are going through, asymmetric information, or is it a systems design problem? What do you think in terms of solutions to this?
It's all of those. It's all of those. So I think, knowledge, of course, is part of it, but the big issue is awareness. Right, we go most of our life with only partial awareness to what we're doing. We don't really think very deliberatively about what we're doing, and we can't think about everything. By the way, there's this beautiful experiment by Ellen Langer in which people stand in line for their photocopier, and you come, this experiment, and you come and you say, "Excuse me," you say, "Can I get in line in front of you?" And people say, "No, there's a line. Go to the back." And then you come and you say, "Excuse me, can I get in line in front of you? I need to make a photocopy." And now people say, "Sure." Now, nothing has happened. Of course you want to go there because you need to make a photocopy. But the moment it sounds like an excuse, people don't process it sufficiently. They just, "Hey, it sounds like a reason. Go for it." So I think lots of life we are not really thinking very thoughtfully, even about our own actions. And we allow ourselves to get tempted into all kinds of things, including our short-term interest. Think about what's happening now with the football thing, right? The deflated football. Can you imagine that a quarterback who is kind of basically been incredibly successful, admired by many, would deflate something on purpose that the cost-benefit analysis in some way would make it worthwhile for him? Of course not. But if you don't think about it very carefully and say, "Hey, this is slightly better, and maybe somebody else is deflating it," and so on, all of a sudden it makes okay. Now, in terms of system design, I don't think that high cognitive awareness on the side of people is can be a solution. That's just not going to happen. What we need to understand is two things. One is, think about the time before dishonesty, during the moment that we're tempted, and afterward. The current legal framework is all about the time after. It basically said, let's create big punishments, and then everything would be okay. Let's just create a death penalty, and then people would say, "Oh, you come home, you're angry, you want to kill your wife," and say, "Oh, yes, there's a death penalty, let's do something else instead." Right? That's the approach. But there's no evidence that this is effective, right? So instead, we need to think of education. What do we do up front? What is the moral standard? And we need to think about the moment of temptation. What do we do at the moment where you file your taxes? What do you think about the moment of temptation? And the other thing is, we need to think about how we eliminate conflicts of interest. Right? Conflicts of interest is basically the fuel for dishonesty. You want to believe one thing. You really, really, really want to believe that one thing. That's what the conflicts of interest does. And then you use all your brain power to basically convince yourself that this is indeed the case. And we're really good at this, right? So what can we do? Can we change human nature? No. But can we eliminate conflicts of interest? I don't think we can eliminate. We can reduce them substantially. And much like other things, conflicts of interest are also very beautiful. So imagine that you and I met for coffee, which I'm sorry we didn't get to do this face-to-face this time. But imagine we met for coffee and I bought you a sandwich and a beer. Actually, if you're in San Francisco, you're probably gluten-free. So I bought you wine and a macaroon. And all of a sudden, you would like me slightly better. Right? And you will start seeing life from my perspective. And that's a beautiful thing, right? Because it means that it's very easy to get new friends and to meet people and to get them to see life from your perspective. But what do you do when this is also what happens in politics and this is what also happened in banking and so on? Now it's incredibly dangerous. So I think we need to recognize the dangers of conflicts of interest, and we need to think about how we reduce them at least to the extent that we can.
Now take this whole progression and apply it to, I know you've studied a lot adultery or cheating in relationships as well through that social network for adultery. Why does it happen? How frequent is it? Is it a knowledge problem? Is it a systems design thing? You know, talk about that whole progress as it relates to that too.
Yeah, so infidelity is very interesting, and we've worked a little bit and talked to the people who run Ashley Madison, which is a website for affairs. The tagline is "Life is short, have an affair." And Noel, the CEO of the company, told me that one day he comes back, he went on some Fox News show with Hennessy, and the guy was shouting at him all the time, and shouting at him, not letting him finish one sentence. And then Noel gets to the office incredibly depressed, and you know, he just wasn't able to talk. And his chief engineer comes in and says, "Our servers have never been so busy." Look, they have tens of millions of users, right? This is not a niche market. And infidelity, I think, is very similar to all types of dishonesty. You know, we're all susceptible to it. And there's lots of ways to rationalize things. Think about this issue of what goes in Vegas, what goes in Vegas stays in Vegas. Right, think about what a clever name this is, because it basically says everybody who's here in Vegas is under this contract that says what goes in Vegas stays in Vegas, and therefore we are under this understanding that what happens here is not reflecting what's in regular life. Right, so maybe if you're home, you think about your moralities and so on. You're in Vegas, all of a sudden there's a social norm that says, this is not regular life. You don't have to consider this. This is a separate issue, and therefore things can happen in a very different way. And to some degree, Ashley Madison is also trying to create a different set of standard and social norms of what is acceptable and not acceptable to do. By the way, another thing that they're doing very interestingly, which is get people to have relationship with people that are kind of assured mutual destruction. So imagine that you have a married couple and a single person. Right now there's a fear of breaking the relationship. But if a married person is having a relationship with another married person, all of a sudden the risk is not as high. By the way, here's the riddle for you. So Ashley Madison has branches in many countries around the world. What do you think is the best predictor of the ratio between men and women in these countries? So some countries have many men and few women. Some countries have basically equal number of men and women. What do you think is the indicator in society that predicts whether there will be more men or more equal?
I don't know, but I'm really curious. What is it?
So it's the income gap. So basically the income gap is the ratio of how much men make compared to women. And when men make much more than women, like in Mexico, there are many men on the site and very few women. And presumably it's because women have no economic power, so there are not many of them. And when you get to a country like Australia, when the numbers are much more equal in terms of income, also the number of people in Ashley Madison are much more equal. So I think, you know, infidelity, I think it's like all the other lying. It's about rationalization and trying to explain to yourself. And I think that people who are cheating don't think of themselves as cheaters. They think of other people as cheaters, but they think that what they're doing is perfectly okay. But it does give us a really interesting, it's hard to study, right? So I can get people to cheat on money and measure how much they're cheating. Infidelity is much, much harder, which is why working with Ashley Madison is exciting, because we are starting to get some better understanding of how infidelity works.
Is that also a systems design thing? You know, for example, Elaine de Botton in How to Think More About Sex suggests that people should be more forgiving when people cheat, but also more, you know, they should be it shouldn't be the norm that people don't cheat. The people should be praised for being loyal over you know, we should still encourage that habit, but we should realize how difficult that is. Or is that just kind of settling or having lower expectations? What do you think?
So I agree with you. I think that, look, the notion of marriage has been with us for a long time. It's an incredibly important notion for the stability of the family when you have kids who can't survive without parents. And we connected sexual intimacy and infidelity with financial security. I don't think those things need necessarily to be connected. So the question is, what kind of marriage institutions are we willing to create? I think it's a really interesting question. It's very hard to experiment with this because the people who are willing to go outside of the norm and do different things are not the same people, right? We're not able to assign people randomly to different conditions. But I do think that the fact that we live for much longer and our sexual lives are much longer, you know, partially thanks to Viagra, does beg the question of what is a good social contract. And so in the study with Ashley Madison, we do find that, you know, unsurprisingly, over time, quality of sex with couples goes down, right? We haven't found a single case when it goes up. But when you ask people about why they are together, very few people say it's because of the sex, right? So here is what you have. You have people who are not having good sex. It bothers them, but it doesn't bother them enough to want to get divorced. So what do you do? What do you do with that? Should we find different mechanism? And I think the guys from Ashley Madison are, you know, they have all kinds of ideas and statements about what should be some other potentials for relationship. We don't have them. So I think that the moment you are in a traditional relationship and you've made a promise and so on, that's one thing. But I think that people should be open to think at least about some other models. And we actually hope that with studying Ashley Madison and seeing what works there, we might be able to propose at least some other candidates and say, here are some other possibilities. Before you decide on which one you're going to do, why don't you consider some other ones as well?
Well, yeah, I'm going back to your last point. It's almost like if not great sex is the real reason, but it's not an acceptable reason, people won't want to accept it to themselves, and therefore they'll, you know, they'll have to work around it. And that's hence the rise of Ashley Madison.
Yeah.
Now, I want to talk about trust as it relates to, you know, personal life. Now, in San Francisco recently, and I'm not sure this is related at all, but there's kind of been this rise or a consciousness of kind of loneliness in Silicon Valley or friendlessness. And when you think about, again, I'm not sure if this is related, but when you think about friends and trustworthiness, how are you, you know, someone who's studied this, identifying, you know, whether it's romantic partners or even close friends, how are you, you know, measuring for trustworthiness? Or do you just kind of have lower expectations of what to expect from people?
So the research on trust is actually very, very interesting. I'll tell you two separate things. One is, there's this beautiful research when they took American undergrads and showed them pictures of Canadian people running for the elections. And they say, who do you think is more trustworthy? And, you know, these American kids picked who is more trustworthy, and that predicts over 90% of the elections, local election in Canada. Now, what it tells you is how much we look at people's faces and infer trust. It doesn't mean that it's true, but we infer trust, and that's what we vote based on. So trust cues are very, very basic to what we do, whether they're correct or not correct. Right? So think about this. Undergrads who've never seen these people predict something from their faces, and this predicts the results so well. So trust is incredibly important. Now, the question of how you create trust. So trust is about, and that's why I think marriage is incredibly useful. Trust is about long-term game and mutual incentives. So think about you and I play the game. Let's say we played something called the public's good game. On each period, we get $10. We put as much of it as we want in a pot in the middle. the money is multiplied by time and a half and then divided equally by the two of us. So if we each put $10, there's $20, it goes time and a half, there's 30, each of us gets 15. But if I don't put in and you put your $10, it becomes $15, each of us gets 7.5, you have 7.5, and I have my 10 plus 7.5, I have 17.5, I'm better off. Right? So this is a game where cooperation, putting all the money in all the time, is incredibly good for everybody. But once somebody defects from the game basically everybody puts zero. Right? If we had a period in which you put everything and I put half, next time you would put zero and I would put zero, and the equilibrium is destroyed. And this is kind of what happens in society. Now, what helps? What helps is if we know that we're going to play 100 games. And now I say, do I really want to screw you over? Because you'll screw me over for the 99 times after that. And what also helps is the ability to have revenge. If I misbehave, you can now take some of my money away or punish me somehow. That also helps. So I think that having long-term relationships where both parties can exert revenge on the other side, and you know you're going to interact for a very long time, actually creates tremendous trust. So in the US, if you're stuck in the same room with another guy and he's your freshman dorm buddy and you know you're going to be with him for 4 years, right, you better play a very different game than if you know that you're working in the cubicle next to this guy and probably in 2 weeks they'll be somewhere else. So I think that transient societies and societies that transient in terms of either romantic relationship or work or whatever basically make it incredibly hard to create trust. I mean, so you would need an extra effort to create that.
And maybe that's what's happening in San Francisco, is just that things change so rapidly.
Yep, and you never know whether somebody would move and so on. Maybe you need to reinvigorate a Tom Sawyer kind of, you know, cut yourself and, you know.
What do you think about, personally, what are ways to train the mind in the moment of temptation? Or really just get at the operating system and make sure that we don't fall for some of these, you know, I don't know, whether it's biases or some of these very common pitfalls.
Yeah, so these are multiple questions here. So in terms of training ourselves in terms of overriding temptation, the research on that is very impressive, right? So the research showing that we can actually learn to meditate and be more mindful and have less temptation, that's really very, very impressive. You can take heroin addicts and cigarette smokers and teach them how to do it. I have to say that personally, I, you know, close my eyes for 10 seconds and my to-do list pops up. I'm unable to sustain more than 10 seconds without realizing all the things I'm supposed to be doing I'm late on. The other part of your question was, can we train ourselves not to have these biases? I think we can think about it in three ways. When we work based on emotions and impulses and not being very thoughtful, the answer is no. When we have a big decision from time to time and we can take a step back and we can think about it more carefully, yes, that's a good time to try and avoid some of those pitfalls. And finally, there's a question of habits. Habits are basically decisions that get routinized and we don't really make the decision anymore. We think about it one time, we create a habit, and that habit stays with us for a long time. And what's nice about that is that if we put some effort to create a good habit, that habit can stay with us. So I would say every time we trust our gut intuition, we will fail. No way to train that. Big decisions, yes, we can stop and think and so on. And another good direction is to think about habits and how do we get good habits.
Yeah. So I want to ask you some rapid fire questions.
Very good. Shoot rapid. Let's see how many questions I can answer in 2 minutes.
Awesome. Who are the two top minds you admire?
The two minds I admire? Living or not living?
Either.
Either. Maxwell and Einstein would be on the not living side. If I had to pick on the living side, I think it would be George Lowenstein, which I admire greatly, And who would be my number two? I'm not sure yet.
Do you ever think about the limits of behavioral psychology and what you study? And do you ever struggle with insecurity about, you know, not being able to find out certain answers as it relates to your personal life or personal improvement?
I certainly think a lot about the limitations. It doesn't bother me. I just think, you know, it's all about making small step forward and trying to fix things to the extent that we can. I'm perfectly comfortable with the fact that there's lots of uncertainty and lots of things we wouldn't know with these methods, and that's okay.
What's a law you'd create if you had power for one day?
And the law stays for longer?
Yes.
I would basically change education. I think education is the big equalizer. So if you think about income inequality, you know, you could do taxes for a while, but the real issue is education. So if I could fix education, I think that would have the most long-term returns I can imagine.
Tell me about how you fell in love with your partner.
How I fell in love with Sumi. We were in a committee. She said I didn't do much work, and I thought I did. But she was basically incredibly thoughtful and articulate and kind of to command. And I basically fell in love with her.
Over a short period of time or a long period of time?
Very quickly.
What should we trust those?
By the way, there's a couple of things that happens when you grow older. I just turned 48. I don't sleep like I used to. Like, I look at my kids and I can pick them up and move them, and they don't wake up, and I don't sleep like that anymore. And the other thing was kind of falling in love in an hour was something that was just incredible. Anyway, it's there's some beautiful experiences that you get as a young adult that are just wonderful at the time. You don't appreciate how wonderful they are.
Why doesn't it happen as you get older? You become more cynical or jaded, or just
I don't know. Maybe hormones don't work in the same way.
That's funny. What do you want people to say at your funeral?
What do I want people to say at my funeral? I would like people to say that I influenced the way that they view the world. And I would like to say that they view slightly differently their understanding of their role in society.
How do you think about implementing, if you are a fan of libertarian paternalism, the concept of, you know, like gently changing systems so people don't even know to help them to make better decisions. How about that in the concept that's in the government? What about that in the context of popular culture or even things like religion or what do you think?
Absolutely. So first of all, I'm not a libertarian paternalist. I'm a paternalist, right? I think that libertarian paternalism basically say, let's do small changes. I think there's lots of things you need big changes, right? I don't see, for example, why let people smoke. I think, okay, we realized how much damage it's causing. We're taxing people who are addicted. You know, I just don't see the reason why we should allow people to do this. I don't see why we should allow people to be tempted by texting and driving. I mean, there's lots of things that we just shouldn't allow. I just don't see the reason for that. So I'm very much a paternalist. And I think there's a question about living versus freedom of choice. I don't think we should eliminate all freedom of choice. But I certainly think that to the extent that we could prove that the choice people get is harmful for them, we should eliminate that.
Yeah, I'm with you. Who comes to mind when you think of the word success?
The word success.
Who strikes you as successful in the way that you mean it or perceive it?
The way that I... So, I think of Watson from Watson and Crick. I think that was a kind of an amazing discovery that he changed things, and he kept on being incredibly productive and prolific after that. So maybe he's the best example.
What question have you never been asked that you'd give a fascinating answer to?
The question I've never been asked. So probably the question I've never been asked and would be interesting is, what would I want to do if I was burned again? So you know, I was burned when I was 18 very badly. So that's the question, but our time is up, so I'm not going to answer it.
Okay. Dan, thank you very much. Are you really? You got to go?
I don't have to go, but I can't answer this question now. Another time.
I appreciate it. Dan, this is fascinating. Last thing before you go, I just had this one idea that someone came up to me. What do you think about college for adults? This concept that at 18 years old, people aren't necessarily ready, you know, developmentally, mentally, they don't have careers yet. What if they had a career for a little bit? Maybe they were a bit older, a bit wiser, not just 22, but maybe 30, you know, because there are a lot of people in San Francisco who've made it, but now don't feel like they belong, don't feel like they're, you know, emotionally developed or intellectually developed. What do you think about this concept of like college for people in their 30-something?
For adults.
Yeah.
So there's multiple versions of it. But if you think about Israel, I grew up in Israel. In Israel, people finish high school and they go for 3 to 5 years for men and 2 to 4 years for women to the army. And in the army, they get a profession and a career. And, you know, some people, of course, you know, parachute or do, but people do all kinds of things in computer science and intelligence and mechanics and all kinds of things. And after that, they go to college. And I actually think it's a very useful model. If you look at the amount of innovation that comes from Israel, I think that basically being, let's say, in the intelligence services for 3 years or 4 years and trying to kind of work with your computer systems and then going to university gives you a very different perspective. So I think from that perspective, it's good. But I also think that in the U.S., you know, without the military service or civil service, I think there is an opportunity to create an interesting grad school. And, you know, I think that basically creating a university for adults is actually a very interesting idea, where you basically say, let's create a university with all the facilities of a university that includes living on campus and sharing your life 24/7 with other people who are completely captured by this topic that they're studying. You know, you'll have to think about what you do with significant others and so on. But let's have also kind of an intellectual fiber to what we're doing and how we think about life. I think that will be incredibly interesting. I would join as a student if you organize that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I need you as a professor. Cool. So fascinating. I will keep you posted. When is the next, what's next for you? You know, just documentary, book. What's the next project?
What's the next project? I recently sent up an invitation for startups to come and hang out with us at Duke. So I want to think about the research we've done on the psychology of money and on health and think about how do we make those into useful tools. So I'm hoping that some people from startups would want to come and hang out with us next year and kind of try to co-create some technologies around that.
Well, this is the prime audience for that, so we'll definitely be in touch. Dan, thank you. Both the documentary and the book will be on Product Hunt soon, and we'll be in touch, man. Dan, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Same here. Take care.
Have a great one.